This is Radio Superior 1945, a reproduction of actual news events with authentic popular music from 1945. This is a true story of our past. Step back with us to another time. We bring you now inside the KUWS radio studios and the Martin and McKenna Show.
This is the voice from the head of the Great Lakes station, KUWS. Jack McKenna reminding you to keep it under your Stetson. It's 6 o'clock Central Standard Wartime, Friday, April 13th, 1945. Lou Martin is standing by with the 6 o'clock news. Tonight we will take an extensive look at the life of President Roosevelt. Morgan Murphy, Father Bill, Rapid Ray will be in too. We will be on the air for an hour tonight, and Lou will have two newscasts updating the situation for you as we go. Good evening, Lou.
Good evening, Jack, and good listeners. The funeral train carrying the late President Roosevelt is on its last journey to the White House. Vice President Harry S. Truman has taken the oath of office, and world leaders express their sorrow at the passing of Franklin Roosevelt. We begin our world radio report from Washington.
This is Washington. Lyle C. Wilson, United Press here. The gray-haired man with the gold-rimmed spectacles walked into the awesome confusion that is the White House yesterday. He came in as Vice President Harry S. Truman and walked out the 32nd President of the United States. He stepped around reporters eager for news about the death of Franklin D. Roosevelt. He walked past red-eyed secretaries and stenographers who could not believe the news. He made his way into the ample green cabinet room where solemn-faced cabinet members sat quietly. It was understandable that Mr. Truman was not at ease. Then up stepped Chief Justice Harlan Stone. Someone gave the Vice President a Bible from FDR's desk. He held it reverentially on his left palm. His right hand was on the cover. The clock on the mantelpiece pointed to 6:08 Eastern War Time. Chief Justice Stone asked him to repeat after him, "I, Harry Ship Truman, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of the President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States." The new president repeated the words after him, except for his name. He said, "I, Harry S. Truman," instead of Ship. Mr. Truman does not have a middle name, and was christened Harry Truman. He added the middle initial later in life because it sounded more official. One of the witnesses to the swearing-in was a man who might have been in Truman's place had political fates been different, former Vice President Henry Wallace, who will stay on as President Truman's Commerce Secretary. Mr. Wallace was so shaken that he had to be helped from the room by Secretary of State Edward Stettinius. Three reporters were present, representing three press associations. Mrs. Truman looked on. She dabbed at her eyes with a tear-stained, rumpled handkerchief. She held the hand of her 20-year-old daughter, Mary Margaret. In this most momentous moment in his life, President Truman took the burden of the world's most powerful office. He pledged to win the war, as Franklin Roosevelt would have done. In Washington, this is Lyle C. Wilson. I now hand off the microphone to Jack Bell.
Mrs. Roosevelt was 11 blocks away at a thrift club meeting when Presidential Secretary Stephen Early telephoned her, asking her to come to the White House right away. Mr. Early and the President's physician, Vice Admiral Ross McIntyre, broke the tragic news to Mrs. Roosevelt in her sitting room. "The President has slipped away," they told her. She said, "She is sorry more for the people of the country and the world than I am for us." Mr. Early then telephoned Mr. Truman and asked him to come to the White House. 10 minutes later, the Vice President heard the news from Mrs. Roosevelt that the President had passed away. Mr. Truman asked what he could do for her. Mrs. Roosevelt then said, "Tell us what we can do to help you." It was after 5 o'clock. Few knew of the President's death. Stephen Early next called news service switchboards. After a pause, he said simply, "Flash, the President has died." That was at 5:48 Eastern War Time. A United Press reporter dashed to the outer office of Press Secretary Jonathan Daniels. He asked if the President had died. A sobbing stenographer said she didn't know what was happening. A moist-eyed Daniels confirmed it. Black limousines began to snake into the White House driveway carrying cabinet members. Interior Secretary Harold Ickes, Labor Secretary Francis Perkins, and War Secretary Henry Stimson gathered in the executive waiting room. 100 yards away, government clerks, sailors, and civilians began to crowd outside against the iron fence around the grounds. The news was spreading fast. This is Jack Bell. Arthur Brisbane has more on the transition of power.
This is Brisbane. The Secret Service Guard, which has been more of a formality and somewhat of a novelty, has been installed to President Truman with Ernest. the modest man from Missouri, is discovering he is one of the world's great public figures with responsibilities to match. Great problems of state are piling up, not for another man, but only for him. The richest nation in the world is adjusting to a new managing director. In the sharpest sense of the word, Mr. Truman is on the spot with as difficult a job as any nation has ever bestowed on one man. His first decision after taking the oath of office was to declare that the World Security Conference in San Francisco would continue on schedule, April 25th. Our new president is a quiet, smiling, easygoing fellow, like the man up the block. Like him, he can get tough, too. This politically sensitive capital would put him down as somewhat more conservative than FDR, but inclined toward the underdog. Above all, there is agreement that the new president is an humble man, profoundly impressed by the bigness of his job. Almost inevitably, there will be some White House changes, but for now, Mr. Truman says he will continue on, as Mr. Roosevelt would have done. He has asked all cabinet members to stay on. The late president's closest advisors were Harry Hopkins and Judge Samuel Rosenman, associates from his days as governor of New York. Their era of influence is ending. The new president will look to Congress more quickly for advice than Mr. Roosevelt. Mr. Truman has a flair for friendship with legislators. This bodes well for better relations between the White House and Capitol Hill. In Washington, this is Arthur Brisbane speaking. Calling Britain, come in London.
This is the British Isles, London calling. Alex H. Singleton here. A solemnly hushed House of Commons adjourned 5 minutes after it had convened in a show of respect for the late Franklin Delano Roosevelt. His shoulders bowed and his face pale, Prime Minister Winston Churchill spoke with considerable emotion when he informed the House of the death of this great departed statesman and war leader. A dear and cherished friend, he said it not fitting we continue our work this day. Tired and worn, Mr. Churchill asked the House to adjourn for a man of immortal renown. A letter earlier to Mrs. Roosevelt, Mr. Churchill wrote, I have lost a dear and cherished friendship which was forged in the fire of war, unquote. All of Britannia, King, Prime Minister, and Commoner moaned that the President, who had been their friend in the days of darkest despair, had been denied the victory of this war. The swelling chorus of tributes to the man who helped turn the tide of war by bracing Britain with a lend-lease when she stood alone was mingled with widespread curiosity over the personality and policy of President Truman. Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden will attend Mr. Roosevelt's funeral. In London, this is Alex H. Singleton calling Soviet Russia. Call me in Moscow.
This is Moscow calling. Eddie Gilmore reporting. Marshal Joseph Stalin led the Russian people in expressing deep personal grief in the death of Franklin Roosevelt. He also made it clear that he would like to continue the Soviet-American collaboration established at the Yalta summit 2 months ago. All Russia is mourning the loss of a man remembered here as having been the Soviet Union's greatest friend in America. The Soviet press printed two-column pictures of President Roosevelt bordered in black, along with condolences from Marshal Stalin and a personal note to President Truman. Every Russian credits Mr. Roosevelt with the speed in which he brought aid to the Soviet Union when Germany attacked in June 1941, even though America was not yet at war. This endeared him to the people of this country. In Moscow, this is Eddie Gilmore calling Sweden. Come in, Stockholm.
This is Neutral Sweden, Alfred M. Schock in Stockholm, where we've been monitoring radio broadcasts from Germany and Japan. The Nazis burst the last bounds of decency today and continued the vilification of President Roosevelt even in death. German broadcasts gloated over his death by pouring out an abusive tirade that shocked the rest of the world, perhaps even their ally, Japan. One Nazi commentator, in a speech apparently written by propaganda chief Joseph Goebbels, said the miracle that saved Adolf Adolf Hitler last year has caused the death of the inventor of this war. The Japanese, too, blamed Mr. Roosevelt for this war, but paid tribute to his position in the war and place in history. Quoting Radio Tokyo, we now introduce a few minutes of special music to honor the passing of a great man. There is at least no question that the world has not seen many men like Mr. Roosevelt in its history. Unquote. In Stockholm, this is Alfred M. Schock. Calling Germany, come in Max Jordan.
Hello, this is the Third Reich, Max Jordan with the Ninth Army, just 48 miles from Berlin. Lieutenant General William Simpson's Ninth Army has made a 60-mile armored dash to the Tangermünde, outflanking Denmark, Hamburg, and Lübeck. General Simpson's Hell on Wheels 2nd Armored Division has crossed the Elbe River. Along the central front, General George S. Patton's 3rd Army is beating down the last 18 miles to the great Saxony city of Leipzig in a drive eastward to bisect Germany from the National Redoubt in the Bavarian Alps. American tanks are fighting Germans 15 miles from Leipzig. The 3rd Army has driven past Weimar, the geographical center of Germany, cutting roads to the Bavarian Alps. Meanwhile, General Omar Bradley's 12th Army and 3rd Army HQ suggest a revolt is underway in the German Air Force. In Germany, this is Max Jordan calling France. Come in, Paris.
This is France, Harrison Salisbury in Paris. General Dwight D. Eisenhower ordered a 30-day mourning period for American troops throughout Europe. His order comes as he confers with his generals on the final phase of the Battle of Germany. Word of the death of President Roosevelt swept quickly here, leaving grief in its wake. Provisional President of France, General Charles de Gaulle, cabled President Truman that President Roosevelt's death brings deep sadness. Flags here are all at half-staff. In cabarets, at the Red Cross Rainbow Corner, and along boulevards swarming with khaki, the reaction is heartfelt. At fashionable Ciro's, the band was silenced, and a leader read the announcement of the president's death. All Allied troops got up and left immediately. A tank brigade sergeant on furlough tried to get through to his commanding officer to allow him to go back to the front. He said, quoting now, "I voted for him 4 times for president. The least I can do is go back up there and fight for him." In Paris, this is Harrison Salisbury.
American divisions continue to push enemy forces back along the eastern coast of Luzon. The 1st Marine Division is mopping up Jap resistance in the Okinawa Isthmus of Ishikawa, while the 6th Marine Division makes gains of the Motobu Peninsula on Okinawa. Today, world leaders mourn the death of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Former President Herbert Hoover, who Mr. Roosevelt defeated in 1932 to become president, said that while we mourn his death, we must march forward. Chinese Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek expressed confidence that the American people and Mr. Roosevelt's successor will finish his uncompleted task. Prime Minister W.L. Mackenzie King of Canada said he was the undaunted champion of the rights of free men and a mighty leader of the forces of freedom in a world at war. U.S. Ambassador to Great Britain John Wynant said the greatest American of our age is dead. Premier Albin Hansen of Sweden, it's a terrible tragedy to mankind. Netherlands Ambassador to the United States, Alexander Loden, said the Netherlands will always remember and revere him as one of the few who, from the very onset, kept the torch of freedom burning through the dark night and understood our sufferings. President Truman proclaimed tomorrow as a national day of mourning, but there will be no interruptions in the flow of supplies to the theaters of war. War Production Chairman J.A. Krug says that President Truman wants all war plants to operate normally tomorrow. Krug says there is no better way to honor the late president than to maintain an unbroken production of war goods. As the nation observes the death of a great man, we also remember those from our hometown who have fallen in the service of their country. The mother of Private First Class Wallace Nesland of Superior has been told that her son was wounded March the 28th in Germany. 18-year-old Private First Class Nesland enlisted last August and was sent overseas in January. The son of Mrs. Hilja Vendela of Station B, Superior, has been told that her son is on today's casualty list from Europe. Private First Class Vendela was wounded somewhere in Germany. Corporal Vilas Warbelow of Iron River, Private First Class Ellsworth Eaton of Siren, Private Leroy Peterson of Spooner, are also on today's casualty list from Europe. The War Department has informed Mrs. Alva Schmitz of Meinong that her husband, Private Alvin Schmidt, has been wounded in action in Germany. Private Schmitz was awarded the Purple Heart. City flags are at half-staff in Duluth and Superior today. KUWS radio newsman Mike Simonson has more.
The Twin Ports joins communities around the nation and the world in mourning the passing of their commander-in-chief. Stunned and unbelieving when the news first came, people were grief-stricken that their leader was gone. The Superior Ministerial Association will hold a union service at the Palace Theater tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock. Association President Reverend Gideon Crane says the Central High School Chorus will open the service. Reverend Harold Nye and Reverend Guy Hill will also take part in scripture reading and prayer. The service will be broadcast over KUWS, WDSM, and WEBC. The Superior Retail Merchants Association says stores will be closed tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Grocers will close at 3, and taverns will be closed between 1 and 5 o'clock. Globe Shipyard will hold a service for the president at 12:30 tomorrow, according to Globe Vice President Roy McMinn. Central High School remembered the president today in an observance led by the Reverend George Senti. East High held a choral service under the direction of Miss Edna Fox. A student read Stephen Vincent Benet's prayer, which the president was partial to. The head of parochial schools, Very Reverend Father Joseph Annebring, conducted services honoring the president. And Douglas County School Superintendent Vera Renstrand says they also held observances. Lou?
Thanks, Mike. We'll have more news bulletins as they come in to us this afternoon. Jack?
Thanks, Lou. It's important to know what's going on during these sad times. We'll have much more about the life of President Roosevelt throughout our show. Let's look at the forecast now for this Friday evening, April 13th, 1945. Colder tonight and tomorrow with partly cloudy skies. Tonight's low will be 25 degrees and a high tomorrow just 40. That's after it hit 62 degrees yesterday. We'll keep tonight's music appropriate for the passing of a great man, friends. We begin with Sammy Kaye and Three Penny Opera on the Martin and McKenna Show. Sammy Kaye and his orchestra with Three Penny Opera. War needs continue, friends, and we have to keep backing the attack, and backing our men and women in the service. But since tomorrow is a day of mourning declared by President Truman, the Boy Scouts salvaged paper pickup has been moved from tomorrow to a week from tomorrow, April 21st. Let's hear the subdued but great sounds of Tommy Dorsey and his orchestra with his theme song, I'm Getting Sentimental Over You, on the Martin and McKenna Show. Tommy Dorsey's theme song, I'm Getting Sentimental Over You, on station KUWS. Lou Martin is in now with a special interview.
Yes, Jack. We're honored to have Mrs. Fred Loss of 2115 Ogden Avenue in Superior. Good evening, ma'am.
You may call me the Widow Loss, Sonny. Everyone calls me that since I lost dear departed Mr. Loss. Mr. Loss was quite the big wheel in his day, you know. He was an alderman and a contractor. As it turns out, if it wasn't for Mr. Loss, the world would be a much different place.
Did you always call Mr. Loss, Mr. Loss, Widow Loss?
I'm at a loss.
Why, yes, I did. The 1890s was a more formal time.
The 1890s, that's when young Master Roosevelt visited Superior.
Visited and almost died in Superior. That's why Mr. Loss saved the world, in a way. See, Mr. and Mrs. James Roosevelt and their son Franklin, I'm guessing he was, let me think now. Oh, about 10 years old at the time, were on one of their visits to Superior. Mr. Franklin had several business interests in Superior, you know. Well, as was the custom of the time, whenever there was a ship launching, all the bigwigs would come and watch. Let me tell you two boys this undisputable fact. I'm telling no tales here. Everyone who was anyone was at American Steel Barge Shipyard for the launching of a whaleback ship. Funny-looking boats, those whalebacks. Big, round hulls so they wouldn't sink. Not many left now. Well, let me tell you, this whaleback slid into the waters of Howard's Pocket. Oh, that's by the Lambourne Avenue Bridge. And like they're bound to do, it created a big wave. Oh, goodness sakes, but who was smack dab in the path of that wave? None other than the future four-time president of these here United States of America, that's who.
Franklin Roosevelt?
Oh, you catch on fast, sonny boy. Well, let me tell you, the boy got swept into Howard's Pocket by the wave fully clothed. Don't you know, quite a few people, especially newcomers, got wet at those shindigs, and Master Roosevelt got his first taste of Lake Superior that day.
And then what? Did somebody save him?
What do you mean, did somebody save him?
Oh, it could have been the end for Frank Roosevelt right then and there. That is, had it not been for Mr. Loss. He moved quickly to the water, thrust out his hand, and jerked the future president to safety. It was quite a thing, that. Oh, quite a thing. That's why Mr. Loss and I voted for him, you know. How many of us can claim we saved the president of the United States of America?
What a story, Widow Loss.
I like telling it. It warms my heart to know Mr. Loss was a hero. And the house I live in on Ogden Avenue, well, Mr. Loss bought the land from Mr. James Roosevelt. It's not far from the swanky Roosevelt Terrace apartments he built.
Thank you, Widow Loss, for your visit.
It's so sad that he's gone now, though. Oh, so sad. Mr. Roosevelt was a good man. There's a picture of him hanging in the living room by the radio. It made it like he was right there with us when he gave his fireside chats. Well, good night, boys. Oh, and I baked some oatmeal cookies for you.
Ooh, I love oatmeal cookies.
Me too.
Now you two be sure and share, boys.
Yes,
Widow Loss.
Nighty night.
Nighty night, Widow Loss. We'll continue to play music in memory of the late President Roosevelt tonight, folks. Here's the Mills Brothers and Till Then on the Martin and McKenna Show.
Till then, my darling, please wait for me. Till then, no matter when it will be, one day I know I'll be back again. Please wait till then. Our dreams will live though we are apart. Our love I know we'll keep in our hearts. Till then, when all the world will be free, please wait for. Oceans we must cross, and mountains that we must climb. I know every gain must have a loss, so pray that our loss is nothing but time. Till then, let's dream of what there will be. Till then, we'll call on each memory. Till then, when I will hold
loss. So pray that our loss is nothing but time. Till then, let's dream of what there will be. Till then, we'll call on each memory. Till then, when I will hold you again, please wait. Till then.
The Mills Brothers and Till Then on station KUWS.
Many civic leaders are sending us their expressions of grief over the passing yesterday of President Roosevelt. City Council President Edie Weldon says the president's death is a shock to everyone and a great and irreparable loss. Steam fitter and plumber business agent Charles Stansky says the president was the best friend that labor had. City Councilor John Green, twice a national delegate to the Democratic Convention in 1940 and 44 for Mr. Roosevelt, said, and we quote now, "President Roosevelt was truly a friend of the common man. While reared in luxury, his life of service to those less fortunate is what made him truly great."
If you don't mind, my son, I'd like to share a few words, too.
Well, certainly, sir. His Excellency, the Most Reverend William O'Connor, Bishop of the Superior Catholic Diocese.
But you know, my son, I prefer you just call me Father Bill.
We all call him that down at the Chancery. Hiya, Father.
That is, when you make it to Mass, Jack.
Well, sometimes you see the war and stuff.
Well, I understand. You're a good boy, Jack.
Jack's church attendance aside, Your Excellency.
Father Bill.
Father Bill.
In the unexpected death of President Roosevelt, the country has suffered the loss of an able executive and a fearless wartime leader. The freedom-loving peoples of Earth have lost an intrepid champion of the rights of man. His memory will be cherished and revered by men of goodwill everywhere for his courageous advocacy of the noble cause of human freedom, social justice, and enduring peace. As no other man in our generation, he has left the imprint of his powerful personality not only upon the life of our country, but of our world. I can assure you, President Roosevelt was a man of deep faith. He had faith in himself, in his fellow countrymen, and an abiding faith in God. America must heed this heritage of faith in the difficult and historic days that lie before us. May Almighty God grant in our new president the faith, courage, and wisdom to lead our country out of the darkness of war and into the light of an enduring peace. Amen.
Amen. Amen.
You know, many people say it's a pity he didn't get to see the end of the war. But let me assure you, he will see victory. Good night, my sons, and God bless America.
Bishop William O'Connor of the Superior Diocese.
Tut, tut, it's Father Bill.
See you, Father Bill.
I'm taking you at your word.
Here's one for Father Bill and all of us. This is Kate Smith and a selection we can find comfort in during times like this.
From the mountains.
Kate Smith and God Bless America on station KUWS. We now go back to Lou Martin with more news on the death of President Roosevelt yesterday.
Once again, good evening, Jack, and good listeners. We began a series of reports on the passing of President Roosevelt with United Press White House reporter Merriman Smith.
This is Merriman Smith with the President's funeral train. Did President Roosevelt know that he was an ill man? Many of us who traveled with him and saw him often believe he did. This was first noticed last year after the Tehran conference. For 2 months, he suffered from sinus problems and bronchitis. It was then that he decided to go to Bernard Baruch's estate near Georgetown, South Carolina, to recover. He was fighting more than bronchitis. He was, I believe, trying to decide if he could go through the rigors of another presidential campaign. He did snap back. His voice was weaker and his tan faded, and he began to spend weekends back home at Hyde Park. Then came the fourth term campaign, which took a terrific physical toll on him. He spent hours touring cities in an open car, often in miserable weather. The Yalta conference in February was a serious drain on the president's vitality. It probably was the hardest 10 days he ever went through in his life. On the ship back, it seemed that he had aged 10 years in 10 days. He sat all day in the sun on the boat. He had lost weight, but refused to take it seriously. He said he would gain it back at Warm Springs. On March 1st, he made his own report to Congress about the Yalta conference, and in his words, "I hope you will pardon me for the unusual posture of sitting down, but I know you will realize that it makes it a lot easier for me to not have to carry 10 pounds of steel around the bottom of my legs, and also the fact that I have just completed a 14,000-mile trip," unquote. That was the first time he had ever referred publicly to his affliction of infantile paralysis. It was also the first time he had taken notice of rumors that swept the country that he was seriously ill, or in some cases, had died. Finally, reporters who attended his press conferences noticed a change. His voice used to boom through the office as he answered our questions. Toward the end, his voice was low and almost inaudible to those in the back of the room. With the president's funeral train, this is Merriman Smith.
This is Gwen Morgan in Washington. Mrs. Roosevelt was at a capital T when a call summoned her to the White House. Smiling and composed, she stood before the ladies at the annual thrift shop charity tea in the swanky Sulgrave Club. She explained that she'd just received a telephone call from her home at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. As guest of honor, she apologized to the ladies before what she called a delightful concert was finished. Mrs. Roosevelt left in high spirits. She was wearing a raspberry red dress, highlighted by several orchids presented to her by the ladies of the thrift shop. Back at the White House, Mrs. Roosevelt was composed. 2 grueling hours went by before she left by Army plane to Warm Springs, Georgia. With pride in her voice and bearing, she said, "I am more sorry for the people of the country and the world than I am for us." She dispatched cables to her 4 sons, all in the armed forces. Each was signed Mother. Quoting the cable, "Your father's done his job to the end, as he would want you to do yours," unquote. Mrs. Roosevelt left the White House, her face gray and ashen, but her head still held high. She was in a morning dress now, with a fur piece around her shoulders. Back at the Sulgrave Club, a woman older than Mrs. Roosevelt, one who had been seated at her right, heard the tragic news. She closed her eyes in sympathy and recollection. She was thinking of her own husband, another great World War president who had died. She was Mrs. Woodrow Wilson. In Washington, this is Gwen Morgan.
This is J.M. Roberts, Jr. with The War Today. For the third time in this country's long search for peace, a great American leader has been stricken in a time of crisis. We know that had Woodrow Wilson retained his health and Abraham Lincoln his life, and had they been able to outweigh their opponents, the history of America and the world would have been far different. Only with the passing of time will we know the effect of Franklin Roosevelt's death. Like Wilson and Lincoln, Roosevelt had passed his war crisis. The crisis he faced was peace, not only victory over armed enemies, but over the issues that make war. He worked with all the hope and power of the United States behind him. Even the bitterest political opponent felt incompetent to go to the mat with him over international intentions. His very personality meant that relations with Joe Stalin, Winston Churchill, and other world leaders, yes, even Charles de Gaulle, took on a personal color. It leaves us wondering to the future, what might have been if only he had lived to see the peace. In Washington with the War Today, this is J.M. Roberts, Jr.
In America's heartland, this is Independence, Missouri. Charles Nutter speaking. Harry Truman is President of the United States today, the third of three increasingly important jobs that he didn't want. He'd be happy to stay Vice President. Truman's first elected office was as a county judge in Jackson County, like a county commissioner in other states. He held that job off and on for 10 years. But what he really wanted to be was county collector. He went to boss Tom Pendergrast, his political mentor, early in 1934, hoping to get his blessing for county collector. No such luck, Pendergrast told the surprised and disappointed Truman. Pendergrast wanted him to run for United States Senate instead. He did, and he got it. Turned out he liked that job. He held it for 10 years, when in 1944, a week before the Democratic Convention in Chicago, someone mentioned his nomination for vice president. Mr. Truman said, "I do not want the vice presidency. I am absolutely honest in my desire to remain a United States senator." Well, he got it. And as vice president, he refused to speculate about becoming president. Again, he got it. Today, the good people of Missouri see their first native son in the presidency, a man who was so poor and obscure in his childhood that he is unremembered in his birthplace. He was the boy whose mother boasted he could plow the straightest furrow in the state of Missouri. He never got to college because of a lack of funds. In 1916, his National Guard outfit, Battery B, was mobilized, eventually going overseas after war was declared in 1917. He was Captain Truman, in command of the Argonne Forest when Armistice Day was declared. When he got home, he had but one thought: to marry his childhood sweetheart, Bess Wallace. Well, he did. He was 35 years old when they were married in 1919. In 1920, he and a partner opened a haberdashery in Kansas City's historic Baltimore Hotel. In 1923, the firm went broke. Instead of declaring bankruptcy, he was still paying bills from that when he entered the Senate in 1935. He pulled his way upward with some political luck that few men have seen in all of history. He owes his career to two men, both dead. One was corrupt political boss Tom Pendergrast, and the other was President Roosevelt. The folks here know Harry. He is modest, loyal, hardworking, frugal, and still rather poor. He takes a great interest in his old World War I buddies. He showed remarkable abilities as chairman of the Truman Committee investigating war contract fraud, and is given to intense old friendships. That's President Truman. We like to call him Harry here. In Independence, Missouri, this is Charles Nutter.
Finally, Jack and good listeners, President Truman said to a group of reporters at the Capitol today, quoting him now, "Boys, if you ever pray, pray for me now." The earnest man from Missouri left a meeting with congressional leaders and shook hands with reporters. "You boys of the press have been good to me," he continued. "I don't know if you've ever had a load of hay fall on you, but when they told me yesterday what had happened, I felt like the moon and the stars and all the planets had fallen on me." And that's the latest news, Jack.
Yeah, he sounds like a great guy, Lou. If he lives up to his name, he'll be all right. Our prayers certainly are with him. Let's listen to a favorite folk song written by Woody Guthrie.
I saw above me, there in the byways, I I went walking, I saw a sign there, and on the sign it said no trespassing, but on the other side it didn't say nothing. That side was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of a steeple, by the relief office, I saw my people. As they stood there hungry, I stood there whistling. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. Stop me as I go walking that freedom's highway. Nobody living can make me turn back. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream.
A popular number written by Woody Guthrie, friends. It's a tune we can take comfort in during this time of sadness at the loss of our president.
Let me introduce Superior Evening Telegram publisher Morgan Murphy with today's editorial comment.
You know, I've always liked Woody Guthrie. His lyrics are for every man, so it's apropos that you play his composition.
It fits, you know. Both he and FDR are men of the people.
I see today's editorial was on the front page of the paper.
We almost never do that, Lou, but we did it when Pearl Harbor was attacked, and again we did it today. Few, if any, moments in history have been fraught with such stunning news as that moment late Thursday afternoon when Secretary Early from the White House announced the president is dead. Because communications today are what they are, the whole world was the audience. Surely never before has the death of one person so shaken the people of the entire planet. This news brings sorrow not only to America, the home and scene of the many political triumphs of Franklin Roosevelt. It shrouds the peoples of every nation on earth in gloom, for above all others who have walked the world stage during this, its most cataclysmic time, the masses in far places have looked to America and President Roosevelt as a symbol of hope that human wisdom might, out of all this, evolve the way to peace and goodwill among men. Fortune played its part in the Roosevelt career. When he was ready for the presidency, it seemed that his buoyant career was due for a grueling test with the greatest economic disaster that had confronted his country. But it was the new president's courageous spirit that started the nation with confidence on new paths towards recovery. As he boldly declared on his first inaugural, "The people want action, they shall have action." Bringing America into this conflict came at a moment when all seemed lost to the people whose freedom had been crushed under the conqueror's heel. Little wonder that America's leader was hailed by the oppressed everywhere as the champion of all humanity. This was a role that he most loved, Lou.
Nicely done.
All this news brings a tear to my eye.
Well, if you don't have a tear today, you don't have a heart, my friend.
Here's Vera Lynn, and we'll meet again on the Martin and McKenna Show.
Let's say goodbye with a smile, dear, just for a while, dear. We must part. Don't let this parting upset you. I'll not forget you, sweetheart. We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies chase those dark clouds far away. And I will just say hello to the folks that you know. Tell them you won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as I saw you go, you were singing this song. Again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny the folks that you know. Tell them you won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as I saw you go, you were singing this song. We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
English songstress Vera Lynn and We'll Meet Again on station KUWS. How you doing, Lou?
Okay, I guess. I have some of the highlights of the president's career. He entered political life in 1913 and served as naval secretary under President Wilson until 1921. He was an unsuccessful vice presidential candidate in 1920. In 1921, he was stricken by polio, but returned to politics in 1924, working for L. Smith's campaign for president. He was governor of New York from 1929 to 1933. When he became president on March the 4th of 1933. He immediately closed the banks for what he called a bank holiday. He had fireside chats on the radio, repealed prohibition, and started the alphabet soup of the New Deal program. CCC, WPA, TVA, NRA, AAA. For a while, things were looking up, but by 1935, the Midwestern Dust Bowl drove people off their farms. Strikes and fights with the Supreme Court marked that year. 1935 was also the year that he set up the National Labor Relations Board and Social Security, then winning a landslide re-election victory in 1936. Recovery is set back by another recession in 1937. But by 1939, with war production gearing up, the country pulls out of the Great Depression. In September 1939, Germany attacks Poland, and the war is on. This is followed by Lend-Lease, isolationism, and his election to a third term in 1940. 1941 is marked by the Atlantic Charter and Pearl Harbor. 1942 is the darkest year of the war, but by 1943, Allied troops are on the advance in the Pacific and Europe, kicking Hitler out of North Africa. 1944 sees his re-election to a fourth term, but he dumps Vice President Henry Wallace in favor of Senator Harry Truman. 1945 is marked by the Yalta Conference, and yesterday, the president's passing in Warm Springs, Georgia. Jack.
Thanks, Lou. Remember that first week he was in office? Boy, that was a pretty scary time.
It was frightening, not having the banks open.
That was scary, too, of course. But I'm talking about those ties you used to wear.
I was just ahead of my time in fashion. It was an uncertain time. Some of those banks never did reopen, and people lost a lot of money. But those that did reopen were solid, and it put the country on a solid footing once again. It does seem like a long time ago.
Well, Rapid Ray is next. Although there's not much to talk about, here's a favorite of many GIs. This is A Deck of Cards on the Martin and McKenna Show.
Folks, here's one of the most stirring and unusual stories to come out of this last war. During the North African campaign, a bunch of soldier boys had been on a long hike, and they arrived in a little town called Casino. The next morning, being Sunday, several of the boys went to church. A sergeant commanded the boys in church, and after the chaplain had read the prayer, the text was taken up next. Those of the boys who had prayer books took them out, but this one boy had only a deck of cards, so he spread them out. The sergeant saw the cards and said, "Soldier, put away those cards." And after the services were over, the soldier was taken prisoner and brought before the provost marshal. The marshal said, "Sergeant, why have you brought this man here?" "For playing cards in church, sir." "And what have you to say for yourself, son?" "Much, sir," replied the soldier. The marshal said, "I hope so, for if not, I shall punish you more than any man was ever punished." The soldier said, "Sir, I've been on the march for about 6 days. I have neither Bible nor prayer book, but I hope to satisfy you, sir, with the purity of my intentions." And with that, the boy started this story. "You see, sir, when I look at the ace, it reminds me that there is one God. And the deuce reminds me that the Bible is divided into two parts, the Old and the New Testaments. And when I look at the tray, I think of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. And when I see the four, I think of the four evangelists who preached the gospel. There was Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And when I see the five, it reminds me of the five wise virgins who trimmed their lamps. There were 10 of them. 5 were wise and were saved. 5 were foolish and were shut out. And when I see the 6, it reminds me that in 6 days God made this great heaven and earth. And when I see the 7, it reminds me that on the 7th day, God rested from his great work. And when I see the 8, I think of the 8 righteous persons God saved when he destroyed this earth. There was Noah, his wife, their 3 sons, and their wives. And when I see the 9, I think of the lepers our Savior cleansed. And 9 out of the 10 didn't even thank him. And when I see the 10, I think of the 10 commandments God handed down to Moses on a tablet of stone. When I see the king, it reminds me that there is but one king of heaven, God Almighty. And when I see the queen, I think of the blessed Virgin Mary, who is queen of heaven. And the jack or knave is the devil. When I count the number of spots on a deck of cards, I find 365, the number of days in the year. There's 52 cards, the number of weeks in the year. There is 4 suits, the number of weeks in a month. There is 12 picture cards, the number of months in the year. There is 13 tricks, the number of weeks in a quarter. So you see, sir, my pack of cards serves me as a Bible, almanac, and prayer book. And friends, this story is true. I know because I knew the soldier.
A deck of cards. On station KUWS. How are you doing, Ray?
Well, hi, Jake. You know, about as good as I can be, I guess. It seems rather pointless to talk about sporting news today.
But the president was a real believer in sports, Ray. He thought it was great for morale at home and the fighting men overseas.
Well, he liked his baseball, even though the Washington Senators usually stunk up the place.
Okay, folks, here's Rapid Ray Paulson with the sports.
Good evening, fans of the sporting world. The baseball camps are silent today as teams took time off to observe the passing of President Roosevelt. These final tune-ups were to end tomorrow as the 1945 baseball season begins next week. The tune-up games between the New York Yankees and the Brooklyn Dodgers at Ebbets Field and the Chicago White Sox and Chicago Cubs at Wrigley Field have been postponed until after the president's funeral. You know, fans, President Roosevelt was responsible, more than any other man, for keeping the big league games going during the war. And up until we entered the war, he had the longest streak of opening day appearances at the Washington Senators' Griffith Stadium, 1933 until 1941. There's other items from the training camps, but, you know, I'm afraid they just don't matter very much today, Jake.
The best way to handle this is to think of the good things he did. Don't forget, he brought back beer. That was fun.
I think that was the only time that I had beer for breakfast.
You know, everyone had a beer that day, even if they didn't like beer.
And I think those fireside chats went a long way to help us get over the uncertain feeling.
Yeah. You felt like you could believe the guy. You know, you had the idea he was on your side.
Hiya, Georgie.
Nice to see you, George G. Newton of the George G. Newton Realty. But, you know, we aren't doing any advertising today because of the president's death.
Well, of course. I don't have to talk business on a day like today. Today of all days. I just came because I think we need to do just what you fellas are doing now, you know. We need to talk.
You're the man for the job, Georgie.
No, be nice. We need to all get along today.
No, that's fine. Jack Boy was just being his old clever self and having some fun. You know, the president was a fun-loving guy. He always had people around him. He loved conversation. He never got tired of it.
He never met you.
That's the spirit, Raymond. That's a boy. A laugh's a good thing when our hearts are heavy. Of course, so is a goodbye on a lake house at Solon Springs. You know, a log cabin with a boathouse and enclosed deck. It'd only be $4,500.
Oh, Georgie, come on.
Just kidding, guys. Hey, play something lively, Jack Boy. You know that song those Democrats love so much that they started playing during the first days of the New Deal?
I know just what you mean, Georgie. I'll do it. Enough somber music. Let's enjoy Leo Reisman and We're in the Money.
One of my favorites.
On the Martin and McKenna Show.
Along.
Leo Reisman, and we're in the money on station KUWS. Attention, all Elks. Exalted ruler Frank Jusen wants us to pass on to all of you, Elkers and Elkies, that activities scheduled for tomorrow night have been canceled. Our respect for the late President Roosevelt, of course. Lots of that going around, Lou.
We have two special reports from United Press correspondents. They're covering the funeral train of President Roosevelt, which is making its last journey to the White House.
This is Calvin Thornton with the President's funeral train en route to Washington, D.C. The slow-moving train is expected to arrive at the Capitol's Union Station at 10 o'clock Saturday morning, a 24-hour trip from Warm Springs, Georgia. Bearing her sorrow bravely, Mrs. Roosevelt flew to Warm Springs to make the trip back with her late husband. The president died at 4:35 Eastern wartime of a cerebral hemorrhage that struck him 2.5 hours earlier. He was 63. The president suddenly put his hand to the back of his head and said he had a terrific headache. They were the last words he spoke. He never regained consciousness. Shortly after arriving in Warm Springs, Mrs. Roosevelt went into seclusion. White House Secretary Stephen Early said the First Lady was carrying her grief nobly. In fact, he called it heroic. The Roosevelt family was being summoned to Washington. Two of his sons overseas will not be able to attend the funeral, Lieutenant John and Lieutenant Commander Franklin Jr., both of the Navy. The president will be buried at 10 a.m. Eastern wartime at the sunlit garden between his Hyde Park home and the Franklin D. Roosevelt Library at the ancestral Roosevelt Estate on the Hudson in New York. While Mr. Roosevelt lay dying, a good number of his friends were waiting for him to appear at an old-fashioned barbecue given by Warm Springs Mayor Frank Elkhorn. The Brunswick stew was boiling in a huge pot, country fiddlers were playing the cat and the chicken, and everyone was on their toes waiting for the chief executive's arrival. That night he was to have attended a minstrel show put on by patients with infantile paralysis. Told the news, the performers, in a throat-clutching sight, wheeled their chairs out of the tiny playhouse where they were rehearsing. Their idol, their biggest source of hope, was gone. It was 20 years ago that Mr. Roosevelt showed them that a person with polio could go on to do great things. With the president's funeral train, this is Calvin Thornton.
This is Merriman Smith. Today, the body of Franklin D. Roosevelt was borne from the little White House of Warm Springs, Georgia, to the roll of muffled drums, starting the last journey home to Washington. The hot southern sun shone in the blue sky as the funeral cortege left the green hills the president loved so well. The procession moved slowly down the mile-long road to Warm Springs Railroad Station, and in the distance, a church bell pealed from some country steeple. The cortege left the little White House at 10:30 Eastern wartime this morning, and along the road stood hundreds of residents of the president's other home. They bared their heads and stood in silence as the late president passed. Behind the U.S. Army band marched 1,000 soldiers, led by three companies of carbine-carrying troops, followed by riflemen. Their colors flew black streamers. Then came the hearse bearing the president's body in a copper-lined, flag-draped mahogany casket. Next was Mrs. Roosevelt, wearing black with a fur cape. She sat stiffly upright, composed as she had been throughout. With Mrs. Roosevelt rode Falla. The dog sat quietly at her feet, apparently sensing something was wrong. Along the road, troops, overseas veterans, stood at attention. Some 2 hours before the faint, muffled sound of the drums signaled the approach of this procession, the patients of infantile paralysis had hobbled out of the main dormitory. Some were wheeled out by nurses. In a semicircle, they watched the cortege pass. Here there were tears, frank and honest sorrow. 13-year-old Frank Freiburg said, "I love him so much." He clenched his teeth to keep back the sobs. Chief Petty Officer Graham Jackson, a Georgia Negro who was a favorite of the president's, stepped from the circle of mourners. He had his accordion, which he had often played for the president. As the cortege approached, he lifted his accordion and began playing the haunting strains of Dvorak's Going Home from the New World Symphony. Then he played Nearer, My God, to Thee. Standing there, too, was old Tom Logan. For 14 years, he had been the president's waiter at Warm Springs. His chin trembling and his shoulders shaking, the white-haired Negro watched the body of his friend pass by. At 10:55, the casket was placed aboard the train by 8 enlisted men, the bodyguard picked for the last journey home. With the president's funeral train, this is Merriman Smith.
You've been listening to Radio Superior, April 13th, 1945, an original weekly production by KUWS Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio. Radio Superior is produced and written by Mike Simonson. Performances include John Munson as Lyle C. Wilson and Arthur Brisbane. Harrison Salisbury is played by Paul Guggenheimer. Duke Skorich as Max Jordan. Don Hansen as Father Bill. Joel Anderson as Eddie Gilmore. George G. Newton is played by Al Katz. John Munsell is correspondent Alex Singleton. Ray Paulson as himself. Al Schock plays Alfred M. Schock. Stan Turner is correspondent Merriman Smith. Shemaine Mills plays reporter Gwen Morgan. Don Mason as Morgan Murphy. Joy Laporte as the Widow Loss. Pat Kelly as J.M. Roberts and Jack Bell. Brian Matusak as reporter Charles Nutter. And Dennis Anderson as Calvin Thornton. All events reported on Radio Superior, April 13, 1945, are actual accounts from the editions of the Superior Evening Telegram. Thank you for listening to this special presentation by KUWS Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio. This is your announcer, Mark Snow, speaking. Good night.